we have the life we deserve and the respect we deserve. That includes money.
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting divorced with financial consulting and strategy. Hi, everyone. We want to welcome today Allie McCartney. She's worked on Wall Street for over 20 years at JP Morgan, Lehman Brothers, and she's managing partner at Alignment Partners at UBS Wealth Management. She's been listed by Forbes as a top New York State wealth advisor, wealth management team, and woman wealth advisors for several years running. You may have seen her regularly on CNBC in her cute Chanel tweed outfits as a regular contributor. And her client base is made up of over 70% women. She's not your average wealth manager. She's the real MFN deal. She has a unique perspective because she has market knowledge. She's worked on the trading desks. She is in the trenches with women who are doing real things with their money that they have control over. Welcome, Allie McCartney, to the Click Line.
Thank you. I wish you could do my intros and just follow me around all the time. I love it.
I'd be happy to do that. So just so the audience understands, could you talk about what a wealth manager does and what type of things that you provide to your clients?
Absolutely. So a wealth manager is a more comprehensive title for anything you may have heard in the past, a broker, a financial advisor, a wealth manager. I would say that the wealthier people are, the more ultimately, the more arrows someone like me has to have in their quiver to be able to help them, because things like philanthropy, divorce, raising children with money, et cetera, come into the picture. And one of the things that I've found, especially where women are concerned, is that whether you have too little money or whether one has too much money, it tends to cause problems within families. And so what I do is really help those families not only navigate some of those issues, but make a lot of impact and a lot of money at the same time.
Great. And so how would you say that you differentiate yourself as a wealth manager? Because there's so many different levels of wealth managers and financial advisors. And when you look online too, there's lots of people giving financial advice. And how would you say that it's different between yourself and others on the street?
Sure. Look, what I tell people that are looking for someone to give them advice financially is that we're all sort of like Dunkin' Donuts franchises. We have access to a lot of the same resources, but we have very different ways of presenting them to different client groups. And so mine is a version of what I call financial feminism. So I say that I work with badass women where the S's are dollar signs and the men who are smart and confident enough to want to invest alongside them. And look, you know, money has a connotation for many, many people. I've spent years and years documenting the words people use when you start talking about investment, legacy, safety. And women need different things. And so what makes me and my team different is I have built a platform, not only from an investment perspective, but from an education and service perspective, that aims to be everything to a very elite group of people. And as the name of my practice represents, alignment, those are people who are aligned with me, where their social values are aligned with their investment values, and what they want to put out into the world is aligned with how they view and treat their own capital.
That's great. And so when people come to you for the first time, for instance, if women are coming to you, what are some of the common mistakes that you see with them managing their money
and also suddenly coming into wealth. What are some things that you're seeing there?
Sure. So, you know, let's break it down to different ways that people come into wealth, right? One is entrepreneurial wealth. You start a company, you spend a lot of time investing your time and money and what we call human capital into something. And for whatever reason, an event in the capital markets, it just becomes very successful. You all of a sudden have wealth that you've accumulated, but you may not have the time or the confidence or the skill set to deal with that. The second would be, as you alluded to, when you come into it very suddenly, and that can often be through death of a parent, through a divorce, through a, let's say, a settlement, through a legal issue that comes up. And when that happens, right, you have this crazy confluence of things where all of a sudden you have a lot of often emotional response to something that happened. It may be a really challenging time in your life. You may have lost someone. You may be navigating some really challenging parts of your life. And so to all of a sudden have the influx of money can be really overwhelming, especially if you've not been the person in the relationship, your relationship with your mother, your father, your grandparents, your spouse, that's dealing with that. And so I think people make a number of different mistakes. The first is that they decide they can do it themselves. It's not to say that one cannot invest themselves, but there's a lot to investment. And as I said, in this world, you know, I live in New York most of the time, you live in California, very tax inefficient states. We constantly have political changes in Washington affecting the tax code. So there are a lot of known unknowns. There are also a lot of unknown unknowns that come in. And so you might be shooting yourself in the foot. The other thing that I see a lot when people choose to invest on their own, and this is just, I mean, there are many, many books about this in finance. It's easy to be invested when things are looking good. It's hard to have discipline and discretion and stay in the game when things are challenging. So what we see a lot is people that sell when times are tough, the pandemic, the global financial crisis, Liberation Day on April 2nd. And that makes them feel great looking at that pile of cash, but they never get back into the markets and they lose the opportunity to make 5, 10, 20% and handicap themselves for the future. So I think that just like we all have things in our life that we feel competent and passionate about doing ourselves, and even then, we often go to other experts or outsource certain parts of that because we realize, especially as women, that we don't know everything and that there's benefit in advisors and community. That's really what I want to put out there through my clientele. But also, I want women to socialize and talk about their investments, their investment managers, their passion about investing in disruptive technologies and women's menopause health, the same way we talk about where we get our highlights done and who does our nails. I want to destigmatize it for women so that we can own our worth and make economic and capital decisions that put us and our children where we need to be.
You know, it's interesting because there's something called the Great Wealth Transfer that's happening right now. And in a UBS report, women are expected to control almost 40% of the U.S. wealth in the next 5 years. And a startling $105 trillion expected to change hands by 2045. Let's go, women. It's our time, baby.
Let's go, women. The power of the purse, ladies.
Yes. So, which is why it's even more important that we take charge in managing our finances and understanding how to do it. And so for me, it's very personal. My father passed away when I was 18, suddenly, and my mom didn't know even how to write a check in his checkbook, right? And so I saw it firsthand how it can handicap a woman, especially now like a widowed a woman raising children on her own, of not understanding finances and not understanding how to manage for the future. And so I think it's so important for women to
stop leaving it up to, oh, the spouse will take care of it, or, oh, I'll deal with retirement later when I'm older, because the time is always now, no matter how old you are, to start thinking about all of these things and, you know, learn about finance and managing your finances, investing and working with financial advisors to plan for all of these events that could happen in your life. And you mentioned divorce, and I know you have a lot of clients who are divorced. I, as you know, do financial strategy consulting for women who are in the process of getting divorced and see finances as a top issue. What are some of the initial challenges that you see women who are divorced dealing with their finances?
Yeah, look, this is a topic that's close to my heart personally and professionally, and I do a lot of work in advocating for women throughout this process. The first thing is, to some extent during the course of your relationship, to demand and occupy your seat at the money table, right? This is a constant building up of proximity and education and confidence so that you understand what you are building together, and so that the first time you've seen your own balance sheet or you talk to an investment specialist is not when you've decided to get divorced. Because come on, ladies, about 80% of divorce is initiated by us, right? Just like we have the chutzpah and the self-respect and the intention and audacity to demand that we have the life we deserve and the respect we deserve, that includes money, right? So you think about women's lib, you think about being able to live the life and inspire the things in the world that you need. This is a capitalistic society. That means money. And so what I often find is that women too late get involved in their own family's finances. And so that it becomes something that is an aha moment that's a lot of like push and pull during an actual divorce proceeding, and you and your lawyers get taken advantage of. So to the extent that you can't be involved and proximate with the finances beforehand, right? We all have the division of labor in our lives, families, marriages. Make sure that you get someone like you or me involved as soon as you engage the divorce lawyer, right? I cannot tell you the things that I have seen from women with hundreds of millions of dollars who don't have their own credit. They can't get a mortgage, a credit card, a debit, right? Women who ultimately get very winning divorce settlements, but take all the assets that have shitty tax consequences, right? So there are all of these things that are being negotiated. And again, it's a negotiation, right? Every divorce is like every business transaction. It's a negotiation. And so leverage is very important. Hopefully you never have to use that leverage, but often the leverage in divorce is information. And so it's really, really important that you have information. And again, just like you would for anything else in your life where you want to win or have an edge, you bring in the right people around you who can support you, advocate you for you, and inform you during that process. And very few women, and quite frankly, very few divorce lawyers bring financial advisors. And I mean that in the total sense, not just what I do, but what you do, anybody that has a background and a capability for dissecting a balance sheet and looking at different assets.
Yes, yes, I totally agree. I can't tell you the number of clients I've had in the ultra net high net worth group who don't have their own credit cards. And it's astonishing. So for people, if you've been on your husband's credit card for 30 years, you have to go get your own. You have to build credit as if you're an 18-year-old basically right now. Because another astonishing fact, women couldn't get a credit card, mortgage, or bank account without a male co-signer until 50 years ago, 1974, Equal Credit Opportunity Act. That's crazy to think about that we couldn't do that before. And so it's so important now. Credit is everything. You know, even if you're going to pay for your house in all cash, you still in the future, you're going to need a car. You may need to rent other places, etc. Build your credit, have things for yourself. And I think that's so important to do. Have your own bank accounts.
Yes, super, super important. And Mina, I want to sort of go back to something you said, which is the experience that you had at your father's passing. Super, super common experience. What I have found is that both men and women who are the children of situations like that, either they had a father pass away, leaving a mother to run the finances, or they had a single or divorced mother. Those are the men and women that understand the imperative of them or the women around them having a bank account, having credit, having basic financial education. Because look, in this country, we provide none of that, right? We used to do things like shop and home ec. We don't even do those anymore. But we don't, you know, we don't teach people about what credit cards are, about why it's important to save for retirement. I often find that at all of these banks I've worked for, that I end up explaining this to the analysts and associate classes because it is so not a part. Financial literacy is really so devoid from our both public and private education, which is why you end up in this world where oftentimes you have someone, right, think about it. If ultimately people are going to work with people they like, trust, and that make the money in that order, there are all kinds of people with money. They're short, they're tall, they're old, they're young, they're male, they're female, they are first generation, they're eighth generation. And so there needs to be just as many people and just the same diversity in our world. But the average person that does what I do, you know, is very sort of straight and narrow. The average financial advisor is a 50 to 70 year old white man. And that may not work for everybody. It often doesn't work for women. They can often feel condescended to or not part of the conversation. It often doesn't work for younger generations who have a different relationship with money and advocacy. So we really need to sort of flip the system on its head and provide accessible financial tools and accessible education and an accessible platform and variety of human beings and professionals to mirror the wealth in this country, which is as diverse as one could imagine.
Yes, I totally agree. And when I had exited a business, it's interesting, I had interviewed every major firm. And you'd be shocked at these meetings that I was in, and just the, even if it was male or female advisors, but just, you know, the presentations were just subpar, I would say, I mean, it was from major institutions that we all know. And so it really comes down to, like you said, the personality fit is key, and someone really aligning with your values and understanding you, right? So someone could, anyone can pitch you anything, but if they really take the time to peel the onion and try to understand you and what your goals are, and they're like, okay, here you are now, this X many years until you're going to retire. How do we plan for that? How do we plan for life transitions? Like, you know, are you going to go back to school maybe? Are you, do you have aging parents that you have to take care of? Are you looking to move? All of these factors are things that your wealth manager should be asking you at the initial meeting. And you'd be shocked to find out how they did not.
I know. So we call that, we call that goals-based planning, right? Which is very different, flip that on its lid, from what most you described like pitches are, which is, this is what I'm going to sell you. This is my one size fits all, and this is how I'm going to make it work for you. that's a very different conversation than here I am. I have all of these both investment, wealth management, and planning capabilities. I want to build a relationship with you so that I understand your goals, so that I know what arrows I have in my quiver and in what proportion and when I can leverage them for you. So when you go from, I have something to sell you, to I want to understand who you are, I want to understand what you need from a financial perspective for your liquidity, the money you need now, and to feel safe when you sleep at night, your longevity. Women's average lifespan right now is actually over 100.
Yes.
You know? So that's a lot of longevity if we want to stop working at 40, 50, 60. And then for those lucky enough to have a little bit or a lot of bit of gravy, that legacy, what's going to build a legacy in the areas that you are passionate about while you're alive and after you leave. And if you have somebody that is approaching you in that way and building a long-term relationship and maximizing the value and the safety you feel with your liquidity, longevity, and legacy, that's when you feel safe, you feel heard, and you can do amazing aligned things together and for the world.
Absolutely. Yes. And just so another fun data point, women live on average 6 to 7 years longer than their male spouses. So another reason you should understand your finances, another reason you should know what is going on with your wealth advisor, with your wealth manager, sit in all those meetings, understand what they're saying, and it's okay. I tell my clients this all the time. It's okay if you don't match with them. It's okay to leave them and go to someone else.
Mina, that's really important. So I see this all the time, right? Where people feel, I have a question, but my person, when I suggest an investment, they tell me it's not suitable. Or when I call, they act annoyed. Or when I ask them to break down my fees, they say, that's really time intensive. And so I try to flip this on this head for people, which is, how much do you pay this person, right? Let's say it's 1%. And let's say you have $10 million. That means that you pay this person $100,000 a year. Are there any other people in your life that you pay $100,000 and you let them treat you like this, or you don't advocate for what you need, right? And so, at least for me, maybe my nanny many, many years ago when they like, but there are so few people. And so you really have to think about, if this were my doctor and they treated me like this, right? I mean, women all the time now, I'm one of them. I have changed doctors. I'm now going to a female-only practice because I feel like I've been gaslighted for so long about some of my premenopause issues, right?
Interesting, yeah.
And so part of this was, I didn't feel, as someone who completely and totally feels empowered and advocates for herself and her clients in the financial world, I felt like, who am I to push my doctor on this? You know, I don't have a medical degree. I'm just one of many patients. And so I tolerated a lot of behavior and condescension until I finally said, no, this isn't right. You know, I don't let anybody else treat me like this in parts of my life. I want someone that's going to listen to me, that's going to make me feel heard, and that's going to follow up on the things that are important to me. And so I think we all have the things in our life where we all know them, and maybe that's why we all file for divorce, you know, more than men, right? Is that there gets to be a point where you start to build those boundaries. And at least what I have found, especially in the relationship between women and divorce, is when you start to build those boundaries in one part of your life, i.e., you say to the father of your children or your partner for many years, no, this isn't okay. I need to be treated differently. that you start to build those same boundaries in other parts of your life. And so that's why I think it's so important to have the right people around you and to do the best you can to prepare yourselves for what you just said and what research tells you is inevitable, which is because of the age of parents, because women tend to outlive their spouses, because divorce, especially what we refer to as silver-haired divorce, so divorce over 40 or 50 when you've actually built up financial wealth in retirement accounts, et cetera, is so prominent. The likelihood is that almost 90% of us at some point in our life will be solely responsible for our financial well-being. And God help us, or the goddesses help us, to make sure that we come into that with, if nothing else, a sense of comfort and having the right team and allies around us.
Right. And I like to tell my clients to, you know, you have to remember the person who cares about you the most is you. So you have to take care of yourself. So you don't have to feel bad that, you know what, John, the financial advisor, has not been serving you correctly and you feel bad because you've known him for 5 years and he is, you know, a neighborhood friend. It doesn't matter. You have to take control of your own life and future because it's not pennies. We're talking about real money here. And you have to take control of that in order to plan, in order to live a better life. And money is freedom. And we all are trying to, you know, have a peaceful, free life. And you can't do that if you're with someone who is holding you back. And like you said, they're getting paid fees and to not provide you with the service that you deserve, then it's time to look somewhere else.
And the respect.
Absolutely.
Right? It's not only the service. And I am in no way saying that as women, the only people that can do that for us are women. There are many men. There are many men on my team. There are many men I work with frequently who are extraordinary at this. But there are many people who aren't, right? And you talked about the word freedom. I say it's freedom, it's safety, it's opportunity, right? It's optionality. It's the ability to get divorced. It's the ability to support our parents because we are that sandwich generation that ultimately ends up carrying a generation up and a generation down. And so I often think, I was privileged to hear Gloria Steinem speak once, and she said very publicly, and I think she's, you know, said it in many interviews, that if she had it to do over, instead of burning bras, she would have advocated for women to take control of their financial capital. Because ultimately, the more power and optionality we give ourselves and the things that we choose to invest in, right? You and I have talked about this. My personal investments that are private investments are not in things that are very Wall Street common. They're in medical technology devices for women. They're in democratizing childcare and breaking up systems that need to be disrupted and broken up, where there's not only significant opportunity to create impact, but there's also significant opportunity to create disproportional wealth because of how long these systems have been left to suffer and stagnate. So choosing not only whether we put our capital with Ali or with Bob, but choosing whether we put it in a solar plant or a fusion plant or in oil, that's what changes the world and the trajectory of equality. Oftentimes people say there cannot be equality of the sexes if there is not financial equality. And I truly, truly, as a financial feminist, believe in that. And I think that it starts with teaching our sons and daughters the same way about money and being really aware and open to some of the stigmas and the taboos that we don't even know or hear ourselves participate in, which I know was certainly the way that I grew up.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so going back to retirement planning, I get this question a lot about how much am I supposed to have saved for retirement? And there's this number that goes around, you should have 24 times your yearly expenses. So if your yearly expenses was 100K, it would be 2.4 million. What do you think about that in general and like a calculation for retirement?
Look, I mean, there are a lot of rules of thumb or sort of, you know, different ways to provide a base level that gets people comfortable as sort of a litmus test or a benchmark, like I'm good or I need to do more. I think ultimately, the answer is you need to work backwards from what you spend. What do you expect that you will spend in retirement? Do you expect that it will be more or less than you spend when you are earning W-2 income or cash flowing? And do you think it will be consistent? The answer is that for many people, when they initially stop working, and I don't even call it like stop working or retiring anymore because we live so long, we do so many things, people are so active. I call it saving or dissaving, right? When you are contributing to your retirement plans, your 401k, your IRA, your cash flowing and saving. When you are not, whether you're withdrawing, you're dissaving. Now, when you are dissaving, you may have periods where you spend more than you did because you travel a lot. You want to take advantage of the fact that you're healthy, that your body's still working, that you have free time, that you may have kids or grandchildren that you want to spoil. And then you may get to a point where, you know, especially if you're living till 101, where your body doesn't let you do some of those things anymore and your travel curtails and some of your needs curtail. So just like during your cash flowing life, your spending ebb and flows, that's likely to happen in retirement. And so I think the way to do it again is goals-based, is to work backwards, to do what people call financial goals analysis, financial planning. And you basically say, in order to spend this much for this long, or in order to live this lifestyle, I am going to need this much money.
Savings on a monthly basis, there's this number of like 10 to 15% of your paycheck saving, and then 6 months worth of emergency savings in case of things that happen like COVID or loss of job, et cetera. How do you feel about that?
In terms of saving, it's a really hard to give you a hard and fast rule, right? Some people need more than they have every month to pay their bills, in which case savings at certain parts of your life may not be something that you can do or that you can focus on. At other parts of your life, you may be able to save a lot more. But the more you can save, the higher your corpus will be. Because remember, if you invest when you're 20, it is likely that that money will have doubled when you're 30, and then doubled when you're 40, and then doubled when you're 50. So imagine the power of compounding. And then imagine that your company matches that dollar. Or then imagine that the U.S. government says, actually, it can grow income tax free. So there are all of these incentives for SEP IRAs, for defined contribution, for defined benefit, for 401k plans. And so the sooner that you can start building up, certainly your retirement savings, and the more you can put into a rainy day fund, the better. But even when you do that, there are still things you can quote unquote invest in, like US Treasury bills, where it doesn't have to be sitting there doing nothing for you. It can still be earning. And so that's why even people, I think, that don't feel like they have enough financial wealth or enough acumen or runway to actually have somebody advising them, would do well to use or to sort of inquire about what with my level of wealth should I be doing. And I guess the other thing I would add to that that I think, and this ties back to what we were saying about finding a person you like, trust, and that will make you money. I think there are some best practices for finding that wealth advisor, for finding your partner in financial planning. I always like to give my clients referrals to people that are very much like them. So if I get to know somebody and I get to know their hopes and dreams and fears, I give them people like them that has expressed similar wants and needs and fears to speak to, so that it's not just me saying, you know, I'm wonderful. I always tell people they should absolutely speak to more than one person.
Definitely.
And, you know, I really think that you should ask people that you respect what they do. Again, this socialization of money, we call it a money posse, right? We need to be able to talk about money, about investments, and be able to share this among other women so that we can share and grow that safety net.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. And with everything, I always recommend multiple options, attorneys, accountants, wealth managers. It's really important to do that. And for the young audience out there, look, I lived in New York City in a studio apartment where I could touch the refrigerator from my bed. It was some tough times. I know how it is. And now an Irwin smoothie is $20. So it's rough out there. I know it's hard to save, but start small. So if this month it's $50 and next month it's $100 and then you're getting, you know, $200, $300, you'll be amazed in 20, 30 years, the compounding of that becoming $500,000.
Compounding is extraordinary. So I say to people, like, and you hit the nail on the head, it's discipline. So whether it's a dollar, it's simply, and I even make my kids do this, right, with their allowance. It's the discipline and the duration that gets you in the habit. And, you know, and the longer that you're in that habit, the more, you know, first of all, compounding will work in your favor, no matter how small it is, the more likely you are to continue that process, and the more likely you are to teach it to the people around you and share that discipline. And actually, you know, I say women can really change the destiny of their dynasty by giving these practices to the people around them. And it's just, it's so, so important. And it's so, so challenging. Like you said, when you have your, you know, your first job in New York City or in Los Angeles, and all you want to do is, you know, go to a bar and have some fun, and you can barely afford to do that. But discipline and duration are absolutely the key to financial wellness.
Yes, 200%. And so I think that's something important for everyone of all ages can work on, budgeting and discipline for the future. Because, you know, years go fast, things go fast, and you want to be able to enjoy life and retirement. And but most importantly, you got to be in it to win it. You have to be in the markets to get a piece of the upside. So you can't do it from the sidelines. So what would you say is one of your most rewarding client kind of experiences that you've had?
I really love working. So it's funny, about half of the women I work with are entrepreneurs who have made their own money. That's a very different experience than when you've come into a situation and you all of a sudden inherit it or divorce from it. But in a sense, it's the same experience. It's of seeing somebody just let go and get comfortable. Right. I mean, there is many of the women I work with, especially on the divorce side, have really been, their nervous system is going crazy. They've been in fight or flight. for a long time. They have a settlement, which means they've come to the end of a really tough road. They're ready to rebuild. And oftentimes they're faced with a whole other set of challenges, right? Which is, how do I do this? How do I make this last? You know, who are the right people? I don't know if I'm picking the right people. And so seeing someone just let go and realize that they are in that safe place and that you are not there to take advantage of them, that you are there to truly partner with them, and that you are there to educate them so that we break the cycle and so that they can own their own worth and really pay it forward. That's what I really love to do.
I love that. And so, as you know, the name of my podcast is Clickline, When Everything Clicks. So when was there a moment, personal or professional, that you all of a sudden felt like something clicked?
Yeah. So for me, it was actually really recent, and it had to do with my own divorce. So 2 years ago, I filed for divorce. And even though I'm the one in this situation that is the financial person and has the proximity, I started to realize that a lot of the things that were happening in my marriage were also happening in other parts of my life. And so when I started to build boundaries and stand up for myself in terms of the things that I needed and required as a spouse, I started to realize that there were other areas of my life, like the relationship I had with people I worked with, that I had really sort of subjugated and tapped down to fit in on Wall Street.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's really been the last couple of years where I felt like I've come into my own with understanding that being who I am as a person, as a mother, as a friend, as a financial feminist, doesn't need to appeal to everybody. I don't need to look like the guys on Wall Street. I just need to really be true and authentic to myself. And I have to tell you that everything in my life, whether it's my relationship with my clients, my relationship with my children, the tribe of women of which you are one around me, everything feels lighter, more aligned, and the universe is really bringing the people, the clients, the men, everything into my life. I used to really feel like there was me as the mom at school, me as the friend, me as the spouse, and me as the financial girl, not wearing too much color and, trying to fit in and keep my head down. And it really all clicked around my finally filing for divorce and just really feeling exonerated, liberated, and like I had finally found my wings.
Wow, I really love that. And thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
I love that story. And I totally feel what you're saying. It resonates with me because I think that oftentimes we have blinders on and just focused on work, focused on certain people, relationships and things, and not on ourselves. And once we start doing that inner work, then all of a sudden, everything looks like it's in a different color in life, right?
It's so true. You mentioned this, and I have a mentor, Diane von Furstenberg, who says this all the time. Your most important relationship in your life is the one you have with yourself, right? And I think, I've done a lot of work on that, and it's made me better as a financial advisor. It's made me better as a technologist, as a media consultant. But it's also made me better able to understand some of the things that tend to hold us as women back and distance them from our financial welfare. And so I feel that although I always felt like I was empathetic and understanding and sort of knew that there was a different model and a different approach that many people needed, I really now feel, back to this word, completely and totally aligned with my clients. And it's a very special relationship, so that, it's often that, I don't know if I sort of joke that clients become friends or friends become clients. but that really feels like where it is. And I don't think you have to, everybody has to have that relationship, but I think it's really beautiful when as a person, as a woman, you can get to a place where you do feel authentic, whether you're making money, spending money, giving advice, or taking advice. And it's a journey, but as DVF says, I have put a lot of time and energy and monetary capital into trying to build my relationship with myself and falling in love with my future. And I really am. And my future and my passion is about helping women own their worth, feel safe and secure, and invest in and empower the things in the economy and the world, especially at this precarious time for everybody, but especially for women and freedom and advocacy. I really feel blessed and privileged that I can do what I do.
That's amazing. You're amazing. Thank you, Ali. Thank you for being on the Click Line. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Mina.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.